You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where this is the space show. The American astronomer Edwin Hubble was the first to establish the rate of expansion of the universe. That rate is called the Hubble constant in his honour and serves to date the age of the universe. One of the major aims of the Hubble Space Telescope was to accurately measure the Hubble constant, which it was able to do, setting it as 73.0 plus or minus 1.0 kilometres per second per megaparsec. The problem is that measurements of the cosmic microwave background radiation made by the COBE and Planck satellites set the Hubble constant as 67.4 plus or minus 0.5 kilometres per second per megaparsec. Well, first some background on the COBE satellite. This report by Frank Tomlinson found in 1990, 1 year after launch.
NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, presents The Space Story. The Cosmic Background Explorer, known as COBE, is confirming for scientists that our universe is expanding in the way Edwin Hubble discovered in the 30s. Just the kind of expansion that was predicted by Einstein's theory. Dr. David Gilman of NASA headquarters was project manager for COBE.
This is our first NASA mission that has been aimed specifically at investigating the conditions in the earliest universe. In that way, COBE is a unique mission, but is driven very much by the scientific desire to find out what was going on right at the moment of creation.
The COBE mission, launched in November 1999, both delighted and puzzled astronomers. It was reported that in the first 9 minutes, COBE blew away mountains of speculation with facts that were soon reported to a major scientific gathering.
The first results were presented to a meeting of the American Astronomical Society in early January 1990. And when the COBE scientist presented his results of the spectrum of the cosmic microwave background, the audience rose to its feet in spontaneous applause. The first time anybody can remember this happening at the American Astronomical Society, because the results he showed fit the curve of an ideal radiator with minuscule uncertainty. In every observation, there are certain small errors, certain small uncertainties that you try to estimate so that your results are not taken to be more accurate than they really are. But COBE has very small uncertainty in its measurement of that spectrum, and through all the points at each wavelength that he was able to plot, he drew a single spectrum of an ideal radiator, and it went right through the middle of each of them. To those who know the significance of these spectra, it was an astonishing confirmation of the initial theory of the Big Bang.
To achieve its mission, the instruments aboard the COBE satellite must be kept cold, colder than you and I have ever known. The years of planning achieved this by placing the COBE in a specific orbit, as explained by Dave Gilman.
It's in a highly tailored orbit. It's almost polar, but in fact it's just a little bit beyond polar, so that its direction of orbit is sort of the opposite of the way the Earth rotates. And this has the advantage that it leaves COBE's orbit approximately side on towards the sun, and the orbit walks around the Earth 1 degree a day, and that way it keeps the same face towards the sun. And then the satellite points away from the Earth at all times. This allows us to keep the cold environment in the shade and also pointed away from the Earth. In the way that we measure temperatures on COBE, the instruments are at about 1.5 degrees above absolute zero.
If the COBE satellite should stray from its orbit for any reason and start pointing toward the Earth or the Sun, it would have an adverse effect on the COBE mission's delicate instruments.
If we were to point at the Earth is at 300 degrees above absolute zero, which is blast our instruments and use up all our helium. And to point towards the sun, I mean, the sun is several thousand degrees above absolute zero, more like 6,000 degrees. And our helium wouldn't last more than a few hours if we were to really point towards the sun. So we have to keep the satellite, the instruments, and their helium in the shade and pointed away from the Earth. The orbit lets us do that.
The theory of a massive explosion was given the designation Big Bang when scientists in 1949, flush with new knowledge of nuclear physics, ran a reverse scenario to when the universe might have been a single point. Again, Dave Gilman.
COBE has provided a dramatic confirmation of this theory from the late 1940s. It's dramatically confirmed the fundamentals of the Big Bang theory.
This has been The Space Story, brought to you by this station and NASA. For the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, this is Frank Tomlinson.
A few days ago, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson paid tribute to Nobel Prize winner John Mather.
And when you think of the universe, and especially what we have learned from the James Webb Space Telescope, how vast that it is. We knew before, and it was a NASA scientist, Dr. John Mather, who got the Nobel that determined that the universe was 13.8 billion years old. And over the years, particularly accelerated in the last century, we have an understanding that, of course, ours is not the only galaxy. And there are billions and billions of galaxies, and each of those galaxies, including our own, have billions and billions of stars.
The discrepancy between the two measures of the age of the universe is one of the outstanding issues in cosmology. It is often referred to as the Hubble tension. Last week, new measurements made with infrared light by the 18-month-old James Webb Space Telescope were announced. They confirm that there is no systematic error in the Hubble Space Telescope measurements. In an article written for the Space Telescope Science Institute, Nobel Prize winner Adam Rice said the Hubble tension, or he said of the Hubble tension, the most exciting possibility is that the tension is a clue about something we are missing in our understanding of the cosmos. It may indicate the presence of exotic dark energy, exotic dark matter, a revision of our understanding of gravity, or the presence of a unique particle or field. Well, here is a 12-minute extract that I have taken from his conference talk.
So I'm going to give a brief review of the Hubble tension, and then I'm going to discuss new results from JWST that are informing us about this. This is work with the SHOES team and collaborators. And I'm going to discuss results in two papers, this HST paper from last year, this new JWST paper, which is accepted in the APJ. And if there's anybody media related, NASA just did a blog. And for those who want to follow along, cheat sheet, the Hubble tension, 0.18 magnitudes. Okay, so one of the great accomplishments of the last 25 years of cosmology has been the development of a standard model of cosmology, Lambda CDM. And this model summarizes everything we know about the universe, particularly its composition. But it's humbling to recognize that about 96% of this model is made of unknown stuff whose nature we don't really understand, particularly dark matter and dark energy, that both have very shallow roots, I would say, in fundamental physics. That is, this is a phenomenological model, and it's used to essentially fit what we see. But it leaves big questions, particularly about the nature of the dark parts. And so, therefore, it's crucial to rigorously test this model from end to end. And one of the only ways we can really test the model from end to end is by predicting the value of the Hubble constant from the model and measuring it precisely. So I'm just going to walk you through that very briefly. But we start out with the model as it looks here, vanilla lambda CDM, and we take the most vanilla form that it can have. So dark energy, a cosmological constant exactly, even though we're not sure about that. Dark matter, a cold particle with no interactions, perfectly stable. We don't know those things, but we assume them. And then we vary six free parameters in this model to predict the scale of fluctuations in the plasma of the early universe. We then compare that prediction to the angular fluctuations, the spectrum of those. And so you vary the six parameters until you get a good agreement between the power spectrum as seen from Planck and the model, and then you use the model as it's now calibrated to predict the entire expansion history of the universe, the dark matter dominated phase when it decelerates, the dark energy dominated phase when it accelerates, all the way to the present time when it tells you the value of the Hubble constant that it should have, 67.4 plus or minus 0.5, very high precision prediction. And so a powerful end-to-end test of this whole story is to directly measure locally the value of the Hubble constant by measuring distances and redshifts. And so we set out more than 20 years ago in a project anticipating reaching this point with the CMB where we wanted a percent level direct measurement of the Hubble constant, leveraging the Hubble Space Telescope largely and using what were considered the gold standard tools of distance measurements. So that is three rungs or connections to make this measurement, and that is geometry, Cepheid variables, and type 1a supernovae. And I'll talk about those in a little bit. I just want to mention this is not, of course, the first effort to measure the Hubble constant. There was a previous generation with the Hubble Space Telescope that successfully reached 10%. In order to reach percent level, we had to redesign the way we made these measurements. And so I want to mention a few of those key things. It's crucial to cancel flux calibration errors along the telescope by measuring, for example, Cepheid variables with the same telescope and instruments on rung one and two, which we do. It's crucial to measure in the near infrared to reduce the impacts of dust. The first generation was primarily in the optical. It is also crucial to use the best quality supernova data, not things from the photographic era of the 1930s, but modern, well-calibrated data. We use the Pantheon Plus sample. It's also crucial to carefully propagate errors all the way from the beginning of the distance ladder to the end to keep track of covariance between data sources with common errors and to undertake a wide range of analysis variants to see if the results are robust. And finally, I think it is crucial to publicly release the data so other people can analyze it. We've released 10 of the 7 data numbers and code so you can read that in. And it's at the GitHub site that I showed on my first slide, and it'll come up again later. All right, so I'm going to briefly walk you through the distance ladder if you haven't seen it in a while. There's been great progress in the first rung. The first rung is where you use geometry to calibrate Cepheid variables. And this is done three different ways now. With parallaxes in the Milky Way, I'll talk about those. Detached eclipsing binary system in the Magellanic Clouds have become very precise in the last few years. And observations of water masers in the radio in Keplerian motion around the supermassive black hole in NGC 4258. And so you take any one of these, they're good to about 1 to 1.5% precision. The great aspect of them is that they're all independent from each other, and so they provide very powerful checks. So let me first show you the progress that's been made in the period luminosity relationship as calibrated by Cepheids and parallax in the Milky Way. And so in order to play this game, you have to get to 40 micro arc second precision in parallax. We reached it using spatial scanning of the Hubble Space Telescope to measure astrometry and photometry. This was surpassed a few years later by Gaia DR3, which now provides the best parallaxes. And even better is to use the parallaxes of open clusters measured by Gaia, but you can average hundreds of stars per cluster to reach 10 micro arc second precision. In all three cases, it's crucial to still measure the photometry of the Cepheids with HST using the spatial scanning because they're very bright sources. And so by the time Gaia reaches data release 4 or 5, we anticipate this will get to about 0.4% in the calibration of the Hubble constant. Alternatively, you can measure Cepheids in the Large Magellanic Cloud to tie to the detached eclipsing binaries. They're far flung, and so we have to use the dash mode with HST, But doing that, you could collect close to 100 Cepheids in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And this shows, as you go from the optical to the near infrared, how Cepheids become better distance indicators. You see through the dust. You can also de-redden as well, so you can really reduce the impacts of dust. And then the third anchor is the galaxy NGC 4258. There's been 6 major campaigns on this with the Hubble Space Telescope to find Cepheids there, now some 669 Cepheids. Okay, on to rung two. Rung two is where you look for nearby galaxies within a redshift of 0.01 or 40 to 50 megaparsecs that recently hosted a Type 1A supernova, and you go back and you find Cepheid variables in those galaxies. This takes a lot of work from Hubble, and there's only a supernova in that volume about once a year, and so it's taken 40 years to collect this sample of 42 supernovae in 37 hosts. And even with an optimistic lifetime for Hubble, I don't think we're going to double this sample again. And so this is basically what we get. It's a very powerful sample for this. We measure the Cepheids in each of these host galaxies. These are the composite light curves of all the Cepheids in each galaxy, which are used to measure their periods and, of course, identify that they are Cepheid variables. And then we measure in 3 colors the Cepheids to measure their period luminosity relation to measure their distances. Okay, so the third step is actually a very famous step. This is the Hubble diagram of Type 1A supernovae. It's been used very successfully in cosmology. So we're essentially measuring the Hubble flow with Type 1A supernovae. We avoid the nearest ones because you would be affected by flows. We don't go out to too high a redshift because the Hubble constant changes, so you have to account for that. So we want to keep it relatively nearby, so redshift 0.02 to about 0.15. So you put this all together, you get one simultaneous distance ladder that takes you from nearby out to the expansion in 3 steps. You do a simultaneous fit to this. It's just a series of linear equations. So we use some 3,200 Cepheids, 300 Type 1A supernovae, this non-diagonal covariance matrix, which now for the first time keeps track of systematic uncertainties, how there are dependencies between different data points. And you do the simultaneous optimization, which you could just do by inverting a matrix since this is all linear, or you could do an MCMC so that you can see the relationship between the different parameters. I hope this isn't too disturbing to anybody, but we don't get the same value as Planck. We get 73 plus or minus 1. That includes systematic uncertainties. You may have heard this before. And this is 5 sigma from Planck. Or if we include the latest cluster data from Gaia, it's more like 5.3 sigma. To really convince yourself, you have to run MCMC samples out to 100 million samples to check the tails. And indeed, we are 5 sigma from Planck, but with a very good fit internally to the data, as you can see from the chi-square. You separate from different ways, different CMB experiments that are predicting the value of the Hubble constant. They cluster around 67 to 68, whereas the local measures of precision are all higher in the 70 to 75 region. There's really no precise local measurement that's coming in lower than Planck. This is what we call the Hubble tension, and it's been around with us for about 10 years. So what is it? I wish I knew. It could be something missing in our understanding of the universe because we use lambda CDM to connect from the beginning to the end. Of course, we also worry whether it could be some kind of systematic error. And so, okay, so getting to conclusions. So this discrepancy, this Hubble tension, it's been around for 10 years. People have looked really hard at lots of different possibilities, different possible sources of error have been studied quite intensely, and no source of error has been found that would explain this. And now JWST, I think, has really kind of put a nail in the coffin of, was there a problem with Hubble's Cepheid measurements? As I said, another way to describe this is when you look at even other measurements, even the ones that are less precise but still relatively precise, they're clustering above. There's no precise one that's coming in lower than Planck. So this is a pretty robust statement at this point. As I said, an exhaustive test of systematics, variations of the analysis. We don't see any sources of excess noise or internal inconsistencies within the distance ladder. JWST has shown that the tension is not due to problems in Hubble measurements. I think that's a very significant contribution to the story. And so I think this is very interesting. I mean, what is actually going on is there's something missing in lambda CDM when we use it to tell the story of the expansion of the universe, really threading a needle all the way from the beginning of the universe to the end. I don't know. Is it new physics? I mean, this is a hard problem because we have very constraining cosmological data. And so it's a very hot topic for theorists to think of extensions to cosmology to explain this. And there have been at least about 1,000 papers on the archive in the last few years that are attempting to do this with varying levels of success or failure. And so I think these results are going to keep people working late on this problem. I'll end there. Thanks.
That's Adam Rice speaking last week in Baltimore. Well, the concept of the Big Bang origin of the universe has worked its way into popular culture. Here, from 2008, is an example by Linda Williams.
There was nothing, and then
Big Bang! Big Bang!
And then the cosmic soup expanded and cooled. The particle zoo was born in the goo. Photons, bosons, gravitons, leptons, energy, radiation.
Watch out!
To form protons and neutrons, hadrons and mesons, fermions and baryons, and on and on and on. Gravity attracts and galaxies form, stars burn up and the elements are born. Hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen and oxygen, chlorine, neon, sodium, magnesium, aluminum and silicon, and on and on and on.
Big, big.